Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shootings in Las Vegas on Sunday and the 74th school shooting since Sandy Hook in Oregon on Tuesday, and speak with Joshua Horwitz, the Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. We will look into the NRA slogan that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is with a good guy with a gun, and how the NRA's reckless and dangerous backing of concealed carry laws backfired in Las Vegas, where a citizen with a concealed carry permit was killed trying to stop a bad guy with a gun. And we will also discuss Joshua Horwitz's article at the Huffington Post, "In Wake of Las Vegas Killings, It's Time to Tread on Insurrectionists." Then we'll examine the alarming statistics of 317,000 trucks involved in crashes in the U.S. in 2012 that left 3,921 killed and 104,000 injured, and look into efforts by Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, to undo recent reforms meant to curb trucker fatigue that appears to be the cause of the crash of the Walmart 18-wheeler that severely injured Tracy Morgan and killed his fellow comedian Jimmy Mack. Henry Jasny, Vice President and General Counsel of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, joins us to discuss how the powerful trucking lobby, the American Trucking Association, exploits and exhausts truckers and endangers motorists and passengers on Americans' highways by buying the political clout in Washington to operate their sweatshops on wheels. Then finally, we will speak with Marcus Stanley, the political director of Americans for Financial Reform, about the way the Wall Street banking lobby has bought off members of the Congressional-backed caucus to give their bills the stamp of left-wing social justice approval while they attempt to roll back key provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act to regulate derivatives. We will look into the irony that while Democrats are running against the Koch brothers in this year's election, a number of House Democrats are carrying out the Koch brothers' deregulation of Wall Street agenda in exchange for campaign funds from Wall Street. And joining us now is Joshua Horwitz, who is the Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He is currently a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the co-author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. He has spent nearly two decades working on gun violence prevention issues, and his latest article at the Huffington Post is "In Wake of Las Vegas Killings, It's Time to Tread on Insurrectionists." Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Horwitz.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're talking about what happened in Las Vegas, of course, with these two insurrectionists who shot two policemen while they were eating their lunch, stripped them of their weapons, put this Revolutionary War Gadsden flag, "Don't Tread on Me" on them, and apparently put a swastika on another one of the bodies, went into a nearby Walmart, were confronted by a customer with a concealed carry permit who pulled a gun on the male shooter. The female shooter came up behind this citizen and killed him. They had an exchange of fire with the police, and then they eventually she shot her accomplice and then shot herself. So this is all happening in the context of where on Tuesday there was yet another shooting at a school, which means that we've had 74 school shootings have taken place since the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, in December of 2012. So that means that the nation averages well over a shooting per school week, one shooting per school week. So this is an extraordinary, I guess to you, and every time I talk to you, it feels like Groundhog Day here, but what's your sense of this latest outrage in the overall scheme of things?
Well, even for me, who has to some degree, you know, work through these problems, issues, when there's a shooting occurs, it often means that I get busy and I have to do a lot of work, and sometimes I have to compartmentalize these things. The last couple of days have been very difficult to bear. This is, you know, I work with a lot of survivors. It's painful for them to watch this happen over and over again. You're seeing, if at least from my vantage point, unbelievable levels of outrage around the country. And I'm obviously, you know, for somebody like me who works on policy issues, trying to change the laws, you're also seeing a lot of activity in that area as well, as policymakers struggle to and scramble to try to respond to these things. And obviously, not enough happened after the Sandy Hook shootings, but there's been a lot of good policy made since then in the states. And I think people are now saying, look, enough is enough. If there's things that we can do as lawmakers, we have to do them. And I think you'll because of this unbelievable tragedy, you're going to start to see even more action on this issue.
But for the longest time, when we have these outrages, years ago, there was a shooting at a school in Tennessee, and they went to the shooter's home, and he had all of these, right-wing books by Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh, etc. And all of those people that propagate these paranoid ideas that America's under siege, that the secular liberal forces are taking over, or Sharia law is creeping in across the plains, and all of this insane stuff. And specifically, Rand Paul was mentioned by this shooter, Jared Miller, who, he'd been to the Clive and Bundy ranch, and he was even too extreme for them, apparently. But when Clive and Bundy first started his little posse aiming guns at the Bureau of Land Management and the police, the Las Vegas Metro Police, who were trying to evict him because he's essentially mooching off the federal government, Rand Paul was the first person to step up and defend Clive and Bundy until he realized that the guy was, in fact, not a libertarian hero, but a parasite. So my sense is that I don't know why progressives in this country aren't more outspoken and don't take these people on. You can't have reckless rhetoric and then suddenly say, oh, I'm not responsible for the actions of people, Don't you find that this is just, these people can't keep claiming innocence when
Not at all. And that's what, that's what my blog is about today. I mean, Miller spent time at the Bundy Ranch. Bundy, was somehow, he had a showdown with the BLM. He had Bureau of Land Management. There's all these quote-unquote militia types who came out to the ranch. They armed, they drew down on federal officials and aimed their weapons at them. And the consequences so far have been none. And I think that's been empowering to the insurrectionists, the people who believe that they have an individual right to take on government to protect what they determine is tyranny, to prevent tyranny, and it's self-determined. And it's clear if you look at the Millers' Facebook page, they were well steeped in this type of firearms ideology. They had liked, they followed the NRA and other they're very, all sorts of other pro-gun sites that tell them that it is their right and duty to take on the federal government when they feel oppressed. And that goes against the most fundamental principle of America, which is equality. We believe that we are equal before the law. We believe that when when someone commits a crime, that they will go to jail. We believe that when people who are served under process of law will be treated the same. But what they're told is if you have firearms, that you don't have to play by those rules. And it's not surprising that people of weak minds start believing that. Now, the NRA tells people that because they want to make money and they want to sell more guns. Let's be clear about that. But what they influence is a whole group of people out there who have stockpiled weapons and ammunition. And this is the result of that rhetoric. I'm not saying that rhetoric should be against the law, but I do believe that morally that rhetoric is what's causing these types of shootings today, and that the responsibility goes right to the feet of the gun lobby and the gun insurrectionists. I also believe that it is high time that we come down on those lawbreakers who do try to push this individual notion of sovereignty, and Clive and Bundy and his followers should be forced to face the full process of the law and not be able to escape because they have firearms. That's what the NRA says. That's what Wayne LaPierre says. The guys with the guns make the rules. And that's what Clive and Bundy is actually pulling off right now. And until there are consequences for facing down, drawing down, and aiming weapons, loaded weapons at federal officials, and not getting off public land, and Ian, you said this right, that's our land, not his land, I think that that we'll see the furtherance of these insurrectionist activities. And again, it's the people with the people who are susceptible to this will pull the trigger, but the moral blame goes to the people who are spouting this crazy ideology.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Horwitz, who's the Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He's currently a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the co-author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. He has spent nearly two decades working on gun violence prevention issues, and his latest article at the Huffington Post is, In Wake of Las Vegas Killing, It's Time to Tread on Insurrectionists. But the other piece of NRA propaganda that's been exploded and exposed for its fatuousness and its reckless dishonesty is this idea. The NRA has been running around the country pushing through state legislatures these concealed carry permit laws. The person who was killed inside the Walmart had a concealed carry permit, and he was killed because he pulled his gun and the woman came up behind him. But the long and the short of it is that this is what the NRA has been saying for years. The best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Well, apparently this good guy with a gun was following the NRA's advice and got killed. Will they take responsibility?
Well, they won't. They'll be silent, and they clearly won't. But, I mean, the part of the issue here is, of course, that's just fallacy. It takes a fair amount of skill, a lot of skill, to use a handgun effectively in those situations. And, you know, law enforcement, the reason law enforcement carry weapons and they can be effective some of the time is because they have a lot of training. I'm sure this person at the Walmart was from all accounts, a great person trying to do the right thing. So I certainly don't want to cast any aspersions on his motives or intent. But we don't know the training level, and in Nevada, there's a minimal training requirement to be able to carry a firearm, and that's just not enough in a live combat situation. Most people don't, you have to really train to be able to deal with that situation. Typically, people get tunnel vision. They get very involved in the moment and stop seeing peripherally, and that may have well happened here, but this shooter wasn't able to assess the situation accurately, as we've seen this in other shootings, and it's very difficult to be able to do that. What we do know, though, is that when you bring a gun into your home, I want to go out stop a criminal, so I'm going to carry a gun. The repercussions of bringing a gun into your home, especially without locking it and things like that, are great. We know that there are more suicides in homes with firearms. We know that there are that you put yourself and your family at risk. And so you really have to think hard about it. And if there's not the adequate training component, and I'm talking at a law enforcement level, it's very difficult to use those in a real combat situation with real shooters firing real bullets. And anybody who tells you otherwise is someone who's never been in that situation.
In your article at the Huffington Post, Joshua Horwitz, In Wake of Las Vegas Killings, It's Time to Tread on Insurrectionists, you mentioned that the NRA has perverted our national debate on the Second Amendment. And, of course, in many ways, the Supreme Court has also made it impossible, in effect, well, certainly making it incredibly difficult to reverse this trend of gun violence, because they totally turned the Second Amendment on its head. The predicate was always that the state shall have well-regulated militias and the citizens' rights to bear arms shall not be abridged. They put the cart before the horse by making the latter the important part, not the predicate, which has been the basis of American law since the American Revolution. What do you think can be done in terms of, I don't know what we can do in terms of the Supreme Court, but in terms of, as you pointed out in your article, the absurdity of this so-called militia movement, these clowns out there at Bundy's Ranch with their guns, and, you know, they're hardly a well-regulated militia, but they're attracting...
Well, they're a mob.
And they're attracting people like the Millers. There was, of course, in July of 1794, the famous whiskey tax rebellion. And what happened there? General George Washington organized a real militia, and they put it down. I mean, that's the point, isn't it? Militias were well regulated, and their job was to stop these armed mobs.
That's why we have a well-regulated militia. It says it, to put down insurrections. That's the point, not to foment or start insurrections, but to put them down. And I think this, look, I think the Supreme Court in the Heller case got that wrong. There's just no doubt that the Second Amendment, and this is what the debates are clearly about, was to protect the state militia from federal incursion. And what I mean by that is taking militia members and sending them to other states, and not providing, dismantling the state militia so that state can defend itself. There's no indication in that debate at all about an individual person using a firearm for self-defense. It's about the federal-state relationship. That being said, and even though they got it wrong, in the Heller decision, there is plenty of room for good policy and plenty of room where we can make good progress on reducing gun violence because, you know, the Heller decision in its own terms said longstanding prohibitions against, you know, felons having firearms and the mentally ill and things like that are still available to us after Heller. Heller was about one thing, and that was banning guns in the home, and that one thing only the Supreme Court said you can't do. But in recent decisions, and we've seen this all across the country, cases with licensing and registration and assault weapons bans, you're talking about dangerous firearms, limiting firearms to those, you know, for those who are dangerous, whether it's because of increased risk of dangerousness, like someone who's really mentally ill or someone who's a domestic violence abuser, all those things have been upheld. In fact, the Supreme Court has rejected a lot of challenges and seems at no great pace to take on another case. And I think that what we have is a very, you know, even though they got the sort of history wrong, what they have given us is plenty of room for effective gun regulations. And in places like California and New Jersey and Hawaii and Connecticut, where they've been able to do that, we see, you know, overall statistically a great reduction in gun violence. So there's a lot to do. But I think for the militia types, I think for those who break the law, we should not just say, oh, well, that's just, you know, these guys, they're out there and they're firearms, let's not bother them. I think if you continue to ignore this movement and not apply the rule of law like you would to anybody else, that movement will grow and be emboldened. The other thing is that they have, you know, let's remember that it appears that the Millers got their guns. He was a felon and wasn't able to buy it, so he probably bought it on a secondary sale. We need to make sure that all gun sales are subject to background checks, and not just the person who purchases it illegally can be held liable, but the person who sells it. And that's what's so important about a background check. It creates a chain of responsibility from the legal purchaser to the illegal purchaser. So there is a lot we can do out there, but we need better federal policy. You know, and one of the things is a great shame that in Nevada, both the House and Senate passed a background check last year, and Governor Sandoval vetoed it, which now I'm sure looks pretty stupid. But there are a lot of great things that we can do out there. There are things that we know will work to reduce gun violence out there. But we're seeing a trend that we're starting to see some of these laws being enacted, even though we haven't got national policy. States are really starting to step up here to the plate and making changes. We just need that trend to continue and grow.
Well, just in closing, Joshua Horwitz, back to the fact that there have been 74 school shootings since Sandy Hook in December of 2012, which means the nation is averaging well over a shooting per school week. The intersection between mental illness and the easy access to automatic firearms has occurred in almost every case, from the recent Santa Barbara case to Sandy Hook, back to Virginia Tech, to the Aurora Cinema. All of those shooters were all demonstrably mentally ill. So what's being done in terms of that deadly intersection?
Well, I think it's important to note that, you know, the vast majority of people with mental illness will not be violent. Okay, so and I think what we need to do is we need to look at where the risk lies. And the risk generally lies for people with mental illness when they're in crisis. And I think that's when the time to intervene is. And I think if you look at what California has done, they have the good start of a model. They have a temporary prohibition for firearms if you've been what's called 5150, which is when you're in crisis and you've been temporarily hospitalized. I think that's a really good start. And also, They've Representative Nancy Skinner from Oakland has put in a new bill called the Gun Violence Restraining Order, which allows family members and friends to go to a court and say, so there's a status change. My friend, my family member, my son, uncle, whatever, is in a crisis. We need to remove the guns from that situation. And let's be clear. Sure, there are times when people with mental illness will be dangerous, but if you look at risk overall, there's lots of other risky behaviors that we need to make sure are covered in this gun violence restraining order. So somebody who could be in a substance abuse crisis can very well be in this, it is at an increased risk of dangerousness. People who are involved in domestic violence disputes, people with prior acts of violence. So it's not just mental illness. Mental illness is actually a small component of this, but some of the most important tools we see on this are now being proposed in California. And this gun violence restraining order, we think, is a great way. If you look at all those shootings, you also know that there are family members out there who are trying desperately to get someone involved. And what we want to do is create an ability for those family members to go directly to court and get an order to remove the firearms and prevent future firearms from people who are in crisis. And we think that will go a great way start to reduce some of these shootings.
Well, it'd be also helpful if there was a way to flag when most of these shooters bought hundreds and hundreds, and the Aurora guy, thousands of bullets and all kinds of guns. And, the idea that they're almost in a competition to cause as much mayhem as possible, that's the dynamic that we're living with today. There surely has to be a way to stop that.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously there are in California. I mean, California, these sales, there's a record of sales, and law enforcement can, law enforcement with handguns and long guns can now see these things. And of course, there's an effort to make sure that ammunition is included in that as well. And that's what civilized countries do, right? When they, that they make sure that people have background checks, they make sure that people who are dangerous don't have access to firearms, and they make sure that people who are dangerous aren't stockpiling all sorts of assault weapons and ammunition. And, slowly we're moving there, but it's just such a shame that we have to have crisis after crisis to get us there.
Well, Joshua Horwitz, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Horwitz, who's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He is currently a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the co-author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. He has spent nearly two decades working on gun violence prevention issues, and his latest article at the Huffington Post is, In Wake of Las Vegas Killings, It's Time to Tread on Insurrectionists. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how Senator Susan Collins is helping the trucking lobby exploit and exhaust truckers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henry Jasny, who's the Vice President and General Counsel of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, an alliance of consumer health and safety groups and insurance companies and agents working together to make America's roads safer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Jasny.
Hello, Ian.
And the crash that involved on the New Jersey Turnpike that involved a Walmart truck driver who apparently hadn't slept for 24 hours, injuring Tracy Morgan, the comedian, killing a colleague of his and injuring a number of others, of course, has brought attention to this issue of highway safety involving 18-wheelers. The statistics are pretty extraordinary. In 2012, the numbers of crashes are up 4% over 2011. 317,000 trucks were involved in crashes on America's roads, killing 3,921 people and injuring 104,000 others. So this is a much greater problem than I think most Americans were aware of.
Well, it's a problem with highway safety. And we know that over 30,000 people are killed every year in traffic crashes. And this is a big chunk of that problem. Even though trucks are only about 3 or 4% of registered vehicles on the road, they are involved in over 10% of the fatalities that occur.
And in terms of this driver who will be in court on Wednesday, maybe we'll learn some more, but there's conflicting. The prosecutors are saying that he hadn't slept for 24 hours, but Walmart is saying that he complied with the federal standards where he rested after 11 hours. How could both things be true?
Well, the rules require him to limit his driving to 11 hours, consecutive hours, and then take 10 hours off duty. It's roughly 21 hours with a half-hour break. He could have observed those restrictions, but not actually taken any rest time in the time he was supposed to be resting and sleeping, so he'd be alert when he got back on the road. So both of those could be true. We don't know exactly what the facts are, but the real issue here is that driver fatigue and overwork is endemic in the trucking industry. That's why a book some years ago came out, and it's still true, calling the truck drivers and the driving conditions sweatshops on wheels.
And just for the benefit of our audience, is that book available?
I believe so. It was written by an economist at Wayne State University, and it should be available in print.
Sweatshops on wheels. So it's not just that Walmart, who have a reputation for being exploitative towards their workers, not paying them a living wage and forcing them often to take food stamps and public assistance with health care, etc. This is endemic across the industry that drivers are exploited?
For non-contract drivers, non-union drivers who don't work under a contract, it's true that they are exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act. So they don't get an hourly wage and they don't get overtime after working 40 hours a week. These drivers often work, according to the government itself, an average of 70 hours a week. Sometimes they can work up to 82 hours a week. They're only paid when they're driving, for long-haul drivers, that is. They're only paid by the mile when they're actually driving. When they're sitting and waiting at a terminal to pick up a load or when they're loading and unloading, they don't get paid for that time unless they have a separate contract. I don't know what the conditions are for drivers with Walmart. Walmart does have an okay record in terms of truck safety violations history. They're not one of the worst companies, but in terms of the conditions under which their drivers are required to drive, I can't speak specifically to that. But I know if this driver is what has been reported is true, the company's supposed to monitor their drivers and make sure that then when they report to duty and report to driving that they're alert and rested and able to handle the conditions of the work that they're supposed to do.
Well, according to federal data, Walmart trucks have been involved in 380 crashes over the last 2 years, leading to 9 deaths and 129 injuries. So,
well, that's a staggering statistic. I don't recall how big a fleet they have. I'm sure it's very huge.
They have 7,175 drivers.
We'd like to get those numbers down.
So, again, I'm speaking with Henry Jasny, who's the Vice President and General Counsel of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, an alliance of consumer health and safety groups and insurance companies and agents working together to make America's roads safer. Well, in the context of our conversation, it's really extraordinary. And as Joan Claybrook, the former head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, said, it's extremely disturbing that Susan Collins, Senator from Maine, introduced an amendment attached to a funding bill last week that would suspend mandatory rest requirements imposed on truckers last year. So tell us what's going on with that. You got the Senate, and in terms of the Senate appropriations bills for the Transportation Department last week, Collins' amendment successfully passed through the committee with a bipartisan vote of 21-9. So what's going on here? Our lawmakers seem to be in a different universe.
Well, what's going on is that the trucking special interests have a lot of money and a lot of influence with legislators up on Capitol Hill. Senator Collins has in the past promoted the interests of bigger and heavier trucks in her own state of Maine, where she wanted and was successful in getting an appropriations provision that allowed 100,000-pound trucks on federal interstate highways in her state. So this is not unique. It's part of a pattern among some legislators who are willing to promote the industry's point of view and try and knock down all the safety restrictions and safeguards that have been put in place to make sure that when these drivers are out on the road, they're awake, alert, and rested and able to deal with the driving job that they have to do.
So is this a case where the public simply don't know? I mean, you know, I think you have, most people and most of our listeners have been driving on freeways. Sometimes when you're stuck between two big trucks on either side, it's a little disconcerting. But the idea that, and I don't know what the number is, but a lot of these drivers haven't rested. A lot of them aren't being paid properly. A lot of them are overworked, stressed out, which I think is a natural consequence. And if you're underpaid and overworked, we have a lot of ticking time bombs out there, don't we?
Yes, we do. We're lucky that it's not even worse. It used to be worse, but it's bad enough when you consider that there are about 4,000 deaths a year in truck crashes. That's a lot of lives and families that are disrupted and lost. The cost to the society is about $85 or $87 billion a year in terms of the payments and medical care and other costs to society. The problem with fatigue is that the rules that were put in place back in 2004 allowed truck drivers to work a lot longer hours and drive more hours than they had previously. 2 years ago, or 3 years ago in 2011, the agency saw this as a problem and put in two provisions to try and take the edge off the amount of hours drivers could be working. It was to require them to get more rest every other week and to sleep at night when they do take their time off. Those are the provisions that the Collins Amendment suspends for about 15 months while a study is supposed to be conducted of those provisions. And we just think that that's a backwards approach. It's taking away the safety protection that even the government found was necessary for the rule they instituted years ago, and saying that we can do without them until we figure out what to do. And we just think that it's an unsafe rollback of protection that's afforded the American public.
Well, of course, Senator Susan Collins is often referred to as a moderate Republican, but the long and the short of it is that we have she's apparently this, her bill to roll back these provisions that only came in 2011, have the backing of the leading truck lobby, the American Truckers Association. So what's your understanding about, I mean, what are the numbers of people that they have, a majority? I mean, the fact that this amendment passed in a bipartisan vote in committee, 21-9, would indicate that they're spreading their money around.
Well, it does indicate that, but it only takes a few leaders to really push it. And then the way the Senate works, especially in committee, is that other people, unless they really have a problem with it, will go along. So she won that vote in the Appropriations Committee, but it has yet to come to the floor of the Senate. And we are hopeful that these issues will now get a better airing. There were no hearings on this provision It was brought up as an amendment, so there's no opportunity to refute the arguments of the trucking industry. And we hope that when we get to the floor of the Senate that we'll have a better chance to make our case.
So specifically, Collins' amendment would stall two measures that were a part of a batch of new rules that were instituted last year, one requiring drivers that take 34 consecutive hours off before starting a new one-week work period. The other mandate requires that time off include two overnight rest periods between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. back-to-back. And these restart requirements only kick in for drivers who hit 70 hours over an 8-day work period or 60 hours over a 7-day work period. When you're just reading those statistics, it seems like that's pushing people really hard.
Yes, and that's what the industry does. And this 34-hour restart that allows them to take shorter rest periods, which was put in 2004, we think is flawed. We couldn't get rid of it. We tried, went to the courts. We didn't win. The agency then got concerned about it, so put in these two reforms to limit the use of this restart. And those are the two safety reforms that were put in that went into effect last year that the Collins Amendment is aimed at suspending. We think that the people who voted on it in the Senate Appropriations Committee didn't have all the information, and we're trying to reach them and get them the information they need to make a better decision when the bill comes to the floor.
And when's that going to be? Because I presume that the Tracy Morgan story has probably reached Capitol Hill. So it may be, maybe if some minds have been changed, do you think?
Well, we hope that this dust-up over the Collins Amendment in the Senate already is having some benefit in the House, because we're trying to keep the same kind of provision out of the House Appropriations Bill. And we're hopeful that we'll be able to do that, in part, unfortunately, thanks to the notoriety of this crash that occurred in New Jersey and involved Tracy Morgan, a famous entertainer. It's unfortunate that that's when the media and people pay attention to these issues, but the problem is that day in and night out, we have crashes involving tire truckers that kill people, up to 4,000, and about 15% or more, up to 30 or 40% of the crashes that occur involve driver fatigue in one form or another.
So what is this phrase of working on the backside of the clock?
Well, that I think that refers to that when you're used up your hours, that if you can continue working.
Mm-hmm.
And since you're not on the clock, it's just a matter of whether you're driving or not. You can take a short rest break of just 34 hours and then continue driving within the same period of time you used to have to rest. You can now continue to drive.
So, again, the statistics are pretty appalling, and the number of crashes, 317,000 trucks were involved in crashes in 2012. That's up 4% from 2011. 3,921 people were killed, 104,000 injured. And, you know, I accept the fact that we're all guilty of not following this story, and it's taken this crash of this well-known comedian to bring it to light. And you've been working on this, obviously, for some time. What's arrayed against you in terms of the lobbying power of your organizations versus the American Trucking Association?
Well, my organization is a small nonprofit organization of 8 people. We work with another group that is a small nonprofit organization of 3 or 4 people. They have volunteers who have been involved in crashes or whose families have been killed or injured in crashes. So we rely on a lot on volunteers. We have 1 or 2 people who could be described as lobbyists, but we are loafers. We don't have big salaries. We don't take Congress people out for dinners. We don't give to their PACs. So we're a shoestring organization working with facts and what we think is the truth about public safety. And arrayed against us is an organization that has untold amounts of money to distribute politically and to hire lobbying firms on K Street to help them get their message across. And it's sort of a David and Goliath story, but we've been involved in this kind of issue and kind of fight many times in the past, and we'll keep doing it in order to protect the public.
Well, but at the end of the day, it seems like the American Trucking Association, its lobbying is a lot of it's about squeezing blood out of a stone. I mean, how much more can you squeeze out of these drivers who, if they're non-union, they have no rights whatsoever, and they don't get paid unless they're actually hauling this stuff. They have, you know, every time they eat or load and unload, they don't get paid. And they're obviously, in order to make ends meet, there's an incentive to push the envelope. It just seems just as though the priorities are so skewed in terms of labor rights and public safety.
Well, it's true. It's a very difficult economic system that truck drivers have to survive in. They're bounced around by the carriers or carriers that hire them to work by contract, by shippers and suppliers where they have to load and unload, and they get the short end of the stick. And if they're only paid by the mile, they have to, all their costs have to come out of that paycheck. So it's a very difficult, as I said, sweatshop-type system. It's not created necessarily by individual carriers, but it's aided and abetted by the fact that these workers are not protected by the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Well, Henry Jasny, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Henry Jasny, who's Vice President and General Counsel of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, an alliance of consumer health and safety groups and insurance companies and agents working together to make America's roads safer. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how Wall Street buys members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marcus Stanley, the Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform. Previously, he worked as an economic and policy advisor to Senator Barbara Boxer, as a senior economist at the United States Joint Economic Committee, and as an assistant professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stanley Marcus. Marcus Stanley, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Ian.
The idea that this sort of cynical idea that the Wall Street lobbyists are buying members of the Congressional Black Caucus to buy their stamp of left-wing social justice approval while they attempt to roll back key provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act to regulate derivatives is pretty disturbing. And what's your sense of where we stand now? Because the new head of the Congressional Black Caucus, Maxine Waters, she seems to be, is she naming and shaming? Would you say that's what she's doing?
Well, I wouldn't say that. A lot of the politics of this, I think, would take place behind the scenes and internally to the Congressional Black Caucus, and it certainly doesn't involve every member of the caucus. But there is this phenomenon where I think Wall Street lobbyists think that they can get progressive credibility by getting the support of CBC members on deregulatory bills. And I would say Maxine has actually played a very positive role in this, because she's the ranking member, the lead Democrat on the House Financial Services Committee. And I think if she had gone along with that, it could have been even more destructive than it has been. But she's taken a stand on several bills where there was a lot of industry pressure, and these were bills that would be and are harmful to financial reform. And she has taken a stand, and as the ranking member of the House Financial Services, she has opposed, for example, bills that would deregulate derivatives activity in foreign subsidiaries of U.S. banks, bills that would lessen protections for people in their pension investments. So I think that's been a positive thing that she's done, because she's in a very influential position as the ranking member of Financial Services.
So, Marcus Stanley, the Democrats who have co-sponsored these Wall Street bills are Representative David Scott, a Democrat of Georgia, and John Carney, Democrat of Delaware, which is a fairly industry-friendly state, of course. And then you've got Representative Gwen Moore, Democrat of Wisconsin, and Jim Himes, a Democrat of Connecticut, again, a fairly Wall Street-friendly state. In this election cycle, Gwen Moore has collected $243,400 from the financial industry. Scott has pulled in $220,160 from the financial industry, and Carney, $353,632. And then Himes, who's also in charge of national fundraising for House Democrats since 2013, he's secured $733,600 from the banking sector for himself. Does that create a problem for the Democrats, that he's the fundraiser for the House Democrats? Doesn't that compromise all of them?
Well, I think that this is sort of a continuing issue in American politics, with the influence of money and fundraising. It is significant. The House Financial Services Committee, I think, prior to the financial crisis and still today, is known as a fundraising committee, a committee that you can go to and get contributions from financial interests. I think there was a perception prior to the financial crisis that these kinds of deregulatory bills, you know, were bills that didn't really affect real people. They were about obscure, behind the scenes rules that govern. That govern the financial sector. They maybe didn't have a direct impact on people. But we found out in the financial crisis that when you create these technical loopholes, it can have a real impact, and that it is important to support regulators in doing things like regulating the derivatives market. And I think that's kind of something that we still have to fight on. I mean, to be fair, you know, some of these people you mentioned, Gwen Moore, even in some cases Jim Himes, you know, they are progressive on issues like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where they do see that direct connection with consumers. But then we have to really bring home the lesson that that deregulating and these kind of behind the scenes loopholes for investment rules, for banking rules, for derivatives rules, is really a significant thing. And we saw that in the financial crisis.
And again, I'm speaking with Marcus Stanley, the Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform. Previously, he worked as an economic and policy advisor to Senator Barbara Boxer, as a senior economist at the U.S. Joint Economic Committee, and as an assistant professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University. But the significance of what's happening now is that the Democrats, of course, are running against the Koch brothers in effect in this midterm election, and yet the Koch brothers and the Wall Street-backed deregulation items, Eric Cantor has folded them into a bill reauthorizing the existence of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, and that is not insignificant, is it? I mean, that's where the price of gasoline and food is determined by, you know,
right,
the extent to which you rein in speculators.
I mean, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is a formerly, I think it was a somewhat obscure agency, but plays a very important role. And it really, in many ways, it's the weakest of the financial regulators, and it's just become a whipping boy for the Wall Street interests, because they know it's a small agency. It's got funding of only about $200 million a year to oversee markets where there's hundreds of trillions of dollars in notional value traded. So it's a tiny, tiny regulator overseeing central markets. And as you said, these include the commodity markets, where the price of gasoline and food is set, everything from the bread you buy in the supermarket to the gas you pump up your car with. And it includes also, it has oversight over the majority of the derivatives markets that helped crash the world economy in 2008. And this is an agency, it's underfunded. The House Republicans have not supported adequate funding for it. There's sort of a constant stream of bills that attempt to go in there and sort of write the regulations from Congress, not giving the CFTC the ability to write its own regulations. And I think one of the most harmful things that we see in this reauthorization bill is these cost-benefit analysis provisions that basically layer on all these legal requirements that the CFTC has to meet before passing any rules. And these are all requirements where Wall Street regulated entities and on Wall Street can sue the agency if they don't like a rule and attempt to overturn it. And we've already seen multiple lawsuits against the CFTC. And even 3 years after the Dodd-Frank Act, the CFTC hasn't been able to implement a lot of its important rules because of these lawsuits.
And they, of course, delay. This is a delaying tactic, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what I think this is the central tactic, that you just try to frustrate and delay the regulatory agencies as long as you can for a period of years at minimum, and possibly you can continue this game for decades. I mean, the Wall Street is in court right now. The major banks, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, all of them, to essentially overturn all of the derivatives rules that the CFTC has passed in the last 3 years, and forbid the CFTC from effectively enforcing them on a lot of the subsidiaries of U.S. banks. And they're just going to continue this tactic as long as they can. And it's crucial that Democrats in Congress, and really no one in Congress, enable them in doing this, act as their enablers. So we are making some headway, even with folks like Jim Himes is going to take a stand for more funding of the CFTC. But it's really important that people in Congress do not support these provisions that allow lawsuits against the CFTC and rewrite their rules.
And specifically, what they want to get rid of here is what's being called the London Whale Loophole Act, because it allows U.S. firms to circumvent the Dodd-Frank rules on derivatives by trading through other countries. So that's where a lot of the lobbying is focused now, right?
Yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of our time on this issue, and I got to say, it's really trench warfare. It's what I would say the effort is an effort by financial entities to get regulatory havens, just like they get tax havens. You know, they get tax havens by operating in foreign jurisdictions where they don't have to pay U.S. taxes. There's also this attempt to search for ways to create loopholes in the rules that will let them do trades through foreign subsidiaries and not be covered by U.S. rules. And of course, you know, when they book these financial activities in a foreign subsidiary, it's really not, you know, the risk comes right back to the United States. It's really not a real distinction between that foreign subsidiary and the U.S. parent. It's all the global bank that we're talking about. So it's very important not to allow these regulatory havens to be created, and to make sure that U.S. rules really do govern the important transactions of U.S. banks, and frankly also transactions by global banks that are really important and central to the U.S. economy. There are a lot of European banks that are very important in the U.S. economy as well.
But the issue, of why Wall Street goes after members of the Congressional Black Caucus to sort of get the kind of patina of left-wing social justice approval, that's also part of and also the New Democrats. I mean, weren't they fighting for slots on this committee? Isn't a committee a lot of Democrats and obviously Republicans as well, and we haven't mentioned that in all of these issues, the Republicans, you know, almost in lockstep, vote in favor of what Wall Street wants, or vote accordingly to what Wall Street wants. But my understanding is that there's quite a competition to get onto the banking committee because you simply make so much money that you, I guess, your re-election's guaranteed, right?
That's right. I mean, I don't know whether any one particular person's re-election is guaranteed, but this is a fundraising committee. It's a committee that's known for the ability to get these contributions. And the truth is, when Wall Street passes a deregulatory bill on a partisan basis, when it's only supported by Republicans, that doesn't have nearly the impact as it has when they can get bipartisan support, when they can get some Democrats on that bill. And particularly if those Democrats are known as progressives, as members of the CBC or generally progressive, that's very valuable for Wall Street to get that bipartisan cover. And that's a lot of what's going on here with this lobbying. And you get people making strategic decisions. Okay, I'll be progressive on these issues over here. But on these financial regulatory issues that perhaps they think are obscure and people really aren't paying attention to, they're going to go ahead and just vote with the lobbyists. And we've seen Gwen Moore do that even on rules that govern, for example, Wall Street transactions in municipal financing.
Sure.
Where we've seen some real abuses on things like derivative sales to municipalities.
Well, Marcus Stanley, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Marcus Stanley, the Policy Director of America's for Financial Reform, and previously served as an economic and policy advisor to Senator Barbara Boxer, as a senior economist at the U.S. Joint Economic Committee, and as an assistant professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.